Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
The theme of the program today is stuff we forget about because there is so much news. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, August 31st. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The news we forget about coming up in a couple of spots later on in the program. First, though, those of you looking to get into the American housing market, take one step forward. Those of you thinking you're going to be able to do it soon because surely the crazy rise in home prices we've been seeing is going to calm down, not so fast. The benchmark S&P Case-Shiller Index, which tracks home price changes in major metropolitan areas, came in this morning up almost 19% in June compared to a year ago, the biggest annual jump in home prices since Case and Shiller invented their eponymous index, 1987, in case you're curious. And I know what you're thinking right now. How is this not a bubble? Does nobody remember 2006 when housing melted down and took the economy along with it? Well, Marketplace's Matt Levin reports that this is not that.
Tell me if this sounds familiar.
Literally within moments of somebody putting a house on the market, they were getting offers like this, and it was sold within like an hour.
Kama Burton is a real estate broker in California's Inland Empire, east of L.A. What she just described wasn't yesterday. It was 2005, and within just 3 years,
homes were abandoned. Grass is dead. Windows are broken. People are squatting.
Burton says housing bubble PTSD is widespread in the exurbs of Los Angeles that were hammered by foreclosures. Prices in the region are up 26% since last year. But she keeps telling buyers, hey, look, you're the reason we're not going to crash again.
Their jobs are still stable and people are doing what they can afford.
The term subprime mortgage is mostly a relic of the late aughts, you know, like Tumblr or good Kanye West albums. Jessica Louts with the National Association of Realtors says millennials with good credit scores are what's driving the market now.
They remember watching their parents, watching family friends go through the boom and the bust.
Zillow economist Chris Glenn says too much demand and not enough supply means the housing market can't tumble overnight. But the double-digit price hikes won't last forever.
We're seeing signs that the market is beginning to cool just a little bit. And by cool, I mean house price growth is slowing, not that prices are going to decline.
Take away record low mortgage rates and flexible work from home policies, and you might even see a housing market correction somewhere on the horizon. Maybe not a crash, but a soft landing. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
All you Kanye fans, do not at Matt Levin on that one, all right? Speaking of bubbles, by the way, Wall Street today. Nah, I'm kidding. It's not a bubble, I think. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a heat advisory in New Orleans today. Heat index is up to 106, and that is for Southeast Louisiana too, and Southern Mississippi as well. There are boil water alerts or no water at all for 750,000 people in the region. And oh, by the way, no electricity for at least that many and none coming for weeks, the power company says. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on that story for us today.
When Norma Jean Matei and her husband decided to stay put in their house in New Orleans for Hurricane Ida, they were prepared for the power to go out for a little while.
We knew going in that we were going to have some uncomfortable nights. But what we didn't expect is to have a major transmission line go down.
Matei is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of New Orleans. And she says having transmission lines go down, the ones that carry power from a long way away, and not just local power lines,
that is a significant difference.
Because now, instead of a few uncomfortable days, people in and around New Orleans are facing the prospect of weeks without lights or internet, without refrigeration.
It affects everything.
Douglas Harris is a professor of economics at Tulane University.
Next to water, I would say the air conditioning is probably the biggest issue because it's just brutally hot now. It's back in the 90s and with humid temperatures, and it's just, it's not really livable.
People with money can cope, Harris says, by evacuating, going to a hotel, buying a generator. But
people with lower incomes don't have the money to do that, and that's why a lot of people don't evacuate.
The top priority right now has to be getting at least some power back up and running, says former FEMA Administrator Brock Long.
Hospitals can only sustain for a limited number of days. And as the power remains off, you're going to have to start evacuating patients inside hospitals to other locations.
Which is especially tough right now. Many hospitals in Louisiana and nearby states are full with COVID patients.
The longer the power off, the more of a threat to a person's life safety there is. No doubt about it.
And the higher the cost of recovery will be, he says, for affected communities. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
I know the news fire hose keeps coming. There is a lot to keep track of, but I want to make sure that we don't lose track of a huge part of what's been happening in this economy the past year and a half. What the pandemic has meant for women, millions of whom have been forced out of the workforce to care for kids or because they make less than their spouse. About 6 months ago, we talked to two women, both of them moms, about how the pandemic was affecting their working lives.
My name is Lauren Pyle. I work in the social services field, and I live in San Antonio, Texas.
My name is Kelly LaFont. I'm an employment specialist in Fayetteville, Tennessee.
So with school already in session in parts of the country, we're starting up real soon in the rest of it, and with the virus still in charge of this economy, we got those two back on the phone. Lauren, I'm going to start with you, and I want to remind people what you had been through and what was going on. You were just a couple of months into a move to Texas. Your husband got a new job. You were a stay-at-home mom looking for work. How's the last 6 months been?
Yep. So I did end up finding a job, basically doing the same exact thing I was doing before. And I just started like 2 weeks ago.
Well, congratulations. How long did it take you to find a job?
Okay, so from the first time that I applied with this particular organization to actually starting the job, I think it was about 6 months. Yeah.
That's a long time of not
having
it.
It was a long time. Yeah. Yep. you know, I was applying for more upper-level jobs that I thought I had qualifications for, but in this organization, you know, you really just have to start from the bottom and work your way up, and happy to do that. Just, yeah, here I am.
Good, good. Kelly, what about you? It was a little different for you last time. If I remember, you were thinking about quitting your job. There was daycare issues and closures and all of that. Give us the update.
Well, I haven't had to quit my job, thankfully. We've transitioned to a new daycare, and the daycare has much better policies. We haven't had any major closures or any kind of extended leave, and I've been able to stay at my job.
That's good, but let me ask you, and look, this gets into you know, life in your household, but who's doing most of the childcare stuff, you or your husband?
We have a pretty good balance. If my son is sick, it's usually me that has to take off.
Yeah.
He makes more money than I do. So his job is more important. Our jobs are equally as important, I like to say, but my job has been the more flexible one. So I end up taking a lot of childcare.
Lauren, what about you and the gap between, you know, what your husband winds up doing and what you wind up doing?
Yeah, so it's funny because he ended up getting, you know, a huge pay increase when he started his new job. And I took a huge pay cut. I think I took about a 25 or 30% pay cut to start this new job. So in our household finances, you know, we're still at a net positive. Like, but me personally, like, I'm way behind now from where I would prefer to be. But, you know, as I said in my last interview, you know, I'm doing what I love. I'm serving people. It is what it is.
It has been, and look, we talked about this last time. It's been a rough year and a half for everybody, rougher for women and rougher still for moms. And I wonder, Kelly, you first, if you're still feeling that.
I would say yes. I mean, you know, with the increase in cases, it is feeling a little stressful. Like, what if my son gets sick? What if I get my son sick? But I'm working. I like my job. I don't want to leave my job. But it is stressful to kind of balance it all.
Lauren, what about you? Stress level?
It was pretty high when the school year started. Those first couple of days were really nerve-wracking. You know, our governor banned mandates in the schools for masks. So I have faith that, you know, even if she does get it, you know, we'll do our best. She'll be okay. But thankfully, our district is now requiring them. They're going against, you know, Abbott's executive order. But that seems to be changing day to day, week to week. So who knows where we're going to be at in a week.
Yeah. Do you think, Lauren, that I'm sure you remember this, but 6 or 8 months ago when women were leaving the workforce by the hundreds of thousands, that was the labor market conversation. It was, what is this pandemic doing to women? And I wonder if you think people are still paying attention to that problem, Lauren.
I don't know. I feel like people are just really focused on all the other things, as we should be. You know, we can't be single-minded, but I don't know that the conversations are really happening about, like, all of that loss of wealth, too, because, I mean, I went 8 or 9 months without contributing to my retirement as well. We haven't really been making student loan payments because we've only been on one income. Like, all of those losses, I don't know how long it's going to take to recover that.
I'm sure you two have thought of this. What happens if in your job or in school or in your husband's work, somebody gets exposed? Have you two thought about that, Lauren?
Yep. So we haven't addressed that with my employer yet. I assume I'll learn that information in the coming weeks or when it happens. So obviously, I'm going to be the one to stay home. And it hurts because I am doing a really important job that people need. My husband, love you again. He is not. If and when my daughter gets an exposure or one of us gets sick or whatever, you know, it's never a question. I make way less than he does. Like, we cannot afford for him to be taking leave without pay. It's going to be me. So,
Kelly, I'm guessing it's the same for you.
It is. And we both work in areas where we could get exposed pretty easily. My husband works in healthcare, so he is in hospitals.
Yeah.
We're both vaccinated, but here, people have acted like the pandemic is over. So I worry that it's not a question of if we will be exposed, but when. So it would be back to where we were last year, where I would be balancing work with a toddler who would have to be out for 14 days, I think is the daycare's rules. It's stressful to think about.
Lauren Pyle and Kelly LaFon, trying to get by. Thanks, you two. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It is stressful indeed. Tomorrow morning, if you get up early, you need the business and economic news, turn on the Marketplace Morning Report, would you? Just check it out. Do me a favor. Coming up,
there was a bait and switch underway.
Well, that's not good. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 39 points today, about a 10%, finished at 35,360. The NASDAQ nudged down 6 points, basically flat, we'll call that, 15,259er. S&P 500 also down 6 points. That is a 10% there, 45,022. Heard from Matt Levin that home prices rose to record levels in June, according again to the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, partly, of course, because demand for new homes is still outpacing supply. We've told you about that. Amy Scott has. So, some home building stocks today. Lennar down 0.5%, 0.5%. Meritage Homes down 0.6%. Century Communities down 0.7%. Allbirds, the maker of those knit wool sneakers with no visible branding, filed for an IPO today, announcing at the same time it had suffered losses this quarter, so that's a gutsy move right there. Activewear Ring is where it goes. Nike lagged 1.9%. Today you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a study out not too long ago looking at disparities in specialty medical care in this economy. Racial and ethnic disparities, to be specific. And as you might imagine, Black, Latino, and Indigenous Americans are less likely to get that specialty care than whites are. Primary care is more equitable across the groups, it turns out. And while part of the cause for the disparity is systemic in how Medicaid is set up, Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reports that that is not the entire answer.
About 4 years ago, May Gaines noticed her menstrual periods were off. They were heavy and lasting sometimes for 2 or 3 weeks instead of a couple of days.
It was just terrible.
Gaines was a massage therapist in Boise, Idaho, but couldn't make it through one massage without needing to change a tampon.
It got so bad that I couldn't stand up at the table for an hour because I was gushing blood so much.
She quit her job and, unable to keep paying for private insurance, went on Medicaid. Gaines thought the extreme periods were connected to a painful heaviness in her abdomen.
When I would go to the doctors, they would say, "You're in such great shape. There's nothing wrong with you." And I'm like, "I am in pain." They would ignore me. It made me feel uncomfortable as a Black lady.
Despite regular exercise and a vegan diet, she gained weight, 60 pounds in under 4 months. Finally, she got an ultrasound that revealed tumors all over her uterus. She was referred to a specialist.
Then I had to wait 3-4 months to get the appointment.
3 or 4 months, not yet knowing whether the tumors were cancerous or benign. One reason it may have taken so long to get seen is because of the type of health insurance she has.
Access to specialist care is an additional barrier when you're on Medicaid insurance.
Dr. Andrea Christopher at the Boise VA Medical Center says Medicaid sometimes reimburses doctors at lower rates than private insurance.
Certain clinics may have a limit on the number or percentage of patients with Medicaid insurance that their clinic can take.
Because Black, Hispanic, and other people of color are disproportionately on Medicaid, they are worse off when specialists limit Medicaid patients. Dr. Stephanie Woolhandler at New York's Hunter College co-authored a study looking at who gets appointments with medical and surgical specialists. She analyzed 3 years of data from patients who saw specialists nationwide.
And we found that for most of the specialties, the specialists were seeing white patients much more than Black patients and other minority patients.
One reason is that fewer specialists have clinics in communities of color.
It's not about who needs the care. Everybody needs the care. It's just the white people are more likely to get it than the Black people.
But the reasons go beyond access. Dr. Sylvia Gates Carlisle directs a family medicine residency program in California and says it's too easy to blame systemic racism on how Medicaid is set up.
Because then it's not race, it's money.
She points to national data. Black patients are less likely to get necessary pain medication and more likely to receive drastic interventions like C-sections. Gates Carlisle tells her medical residents that if they care about eliminating racism in healthcare, they should track how they personally diagnose and treat patients.
Assume until you can prove otherwise that you're no better than the system.
Back in Boise, after Mae Gaines finally got in with specialists, she learned her uterus was full of benign fibroid tumors.
The fibroids in my stomach was so large, it was equivalent to a 6.5 month pregnancy.
At that point, she got great health care from doctors she trusted. At 49, she was scheduled for a hysterectomy to remove the fibroids. She was nervous.
I had a goal to live longer than my mother, and my mother died at 49.
The surgery went well, and a few weeks ago, Gaines made it to 50. She celebrated her birthday, meditating and thinking about her mom. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
Okay, item two in the forgotten news files. You remember the Paycheck Protection Program from back in the early-ish days of the pandemic? Almost $800 billion in loans meant for small businesses, designed to help those small companies make payroll and A, help them survive the pandemic, and B, help the employees survive too. The promise was that if those business owners used the money the way the rules said they had to use the money, the loans would be fully forgiven. So far, the Small Business Administration says 6% of borrowers who've applied for forgiveness have been told they're going to have to pay back some portion of their loans. And look, 6% isn't on the face of it a whole lot, but it does add up to more than $27 billion, and half of borrowers have yet to finish the forgiveness paperwork. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at what went wrong here.
Okay, so I just got off the subway in Manhattan. And I'm looking for Andrew Song's restaurant / karaoke bar. I told Andrew I would take a picture for him.
Well, all it's going to do is make me a little bit depressed about it.
That's Andrew Song. He closed his restaurant, Le Midi, last summer after 8 years. Since then, he's moved to London and hasn't been back. He didn't want to see the photo I took, but he did have some questions.
What was it like?
The space is still there. No one's taken over. The menu's still in the door.
That's a shame.
The shuttered restaurant doesn't just represent his passion. Now it represents his debt. The business got nearly $250,000 in PPP funding, and his lender, Citibank, told him he has to pay back more than $25,000. Song can't figure out why. Was it something in his application? Did he not follow the program's guidelines? Is he even liable for the money since his business closed?
I couldn't get a clear answer. No one picks up phone calls. No emails are returned. It feels like you are dealing with a faceless organization.
Song isn't the only confused business owner out there. A study from the National Federation of Independent Business says 3/4 of borrowers found the terms and conditions of PPP difficult to understand. Nicholas Anthony at the Cato Institute isn't surprised.
The hardest part for small businesses was probably the speed at which this program came together.
The point of PPP was to inject billions of dollars into the economy, and fast. But since it was an unprecedented program, there was no roadmap to follow.
And because of that, it was more like a framework was offered than a full, robust program.
Case in point, the paperwork. Since the start of PPP, the Small Business Administration's calculation guide has been updated 3 times. Its first draw application form, updated 9. Even the SBA admits PPP's initial rollout wasn't perfect. Patrick Kelly has been associate administrator of the SBA's Office of Capital Access since March.
It felt, I imagine, for borrowers that there was a bait and switch underway where the promise was forgiveness, but the practical reality of the agency's rules regarding forgiveness were incredibly complex and scary.
But who will literally pay the price for the SBA's complex rules or possible bank errors? Kelly says if borrowers filled out forms wrong or used the money outside of the forgiveness guidelines,
ultimately, the borrower is a debtor.
One of those debtors is Ryan Chapman, a chiropractor in Burbank, California. He says his lender, Bank of America, told him to apply using 2020 earnings estimates instead of 2019 tax returns because he'd recently tripled his staff. Now Bank of America says that was a mistake. Chapman was overfunded $8,000 and has to pay it back.
I didn't need to bring back all those employees right then. Like, our business was still slow. And I was paying them with money that I had to pay them with because of the stipulations. And then at the end, I had to give all that money back.
He doesn't think this is his fault and tried to get his bank and the SBA to review his case.
I spent probably, I'm not even kidding, 50 to 100 hours on the phone. And honestly, it was just stressing me out. So I finally, just for my own peace of mind, just took the money out of my savings account and just paid it off so I could just be done with it.
It was money he'd been saving for a down payment on a house. Big picture, PPP worked for most small business owners. And even though Chapman had to cough up $8,000, he says he'd do it all over again. He'd just do it differently. He's already moved his business accounts to a local community bank, which he says at least answers his phone calls. Both lenders in this story, Bank of America and Citibank, told us they're working closely with every borrower who's applying for PPP loan forgiveness while also following the program's rules. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I suppose there is no accounting for taste. Remember, I've mentioned a couple of times the Kraft mac and cheese flavored ice cream, a co-branding experiment from Kraft and Van Leeuwen Ice Cream out of New York. Anyway, it was announced, I don't know, a month, 2 months ago, whatever, to some derision here and elsewhere. Then it sold out to some astonishment here and elsewhere. Now it's back in stock. So have at it. I'm out of this one. Except to say that Kraft shares up 5% year to date. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, natural disaster edition. Wells Fargo and Fitch, report the Wall Street Journal, figure insured losses from Hurricane Ida are going to be in the $15 to $20 billion range. Climate change is an economic story, gang. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.